Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands. Today, we're so excited to welcome Stacey Stewart, the CEO of the March of Dimes. So, Stacey, you started your career in finance. What led you down that path?
I wanted to make money. You know, it's funny because, I was just talking to my youngest daughter. I have two daughters, one 18 and one 16, and I was talking to one of them, my youngest one, about how I used to spend my summers, and I was explaining that I had an internship, you know, in, I think it was the first time I interned with the First National Bank of Atlanta, which was subsequently bought by Wachovia. Now it's really Wells Fargo, I guess, now, and was, I guess, in between my junior and senior years in high school. And it was back then that I knew I had an interest in banking and didn't know where that would lead. But my mother's best friend can remember talking about, you know, being not well off or, you know, whatever, but just doing well in my life financially, even when I was a little girl. So I guess that was it. I mean, finance seemed to be the way to make money. So I just did that.
So tell us what your family's relationship was like with money growing up.
Well, you know, I didn't grow up in a wealthy family, but my father was a physician and my mother, my dad, you know, I mean, this is showing my age a little bit. When I was young, my dad was, it wasn't the thing to have your wife working, even though my mother was super, super smart. You know, she was the valedictorian of her class. She was homecoming queen, like, you know, everything like that. She was that girl, you know, like the homecoming queen and the valedictorian, like crazy. But for a physician, you know, and I was born in the 60s, you could live a pretty comfortable lifestyle, you know. And so, and especially as a black family, you know, you were considered kind of upper middle class for a black family, you know. And I lived in a really comfortable neighborhood. If you go to look in the neighborhood I grew up in, you would call it modest at best. It was a kind of a modest American neighborhood, but it was a really, really nice neighborhood when I was growing up. And so it was really more than that. It wasn't really so much the money about it. It was more, my neighborhood was more full of very accomplished black people. You know, my neighborhood, just quickly, I'll tell you that in Atlanta when I was growing up, after white flight happened, and a lot of white families left parts of Atlanta, many of those neighborhoods were full of homes that were then bought by upwardly mobile black families, especially in Southwest Atlanta. If anyone knows Southwest Atlanta today, everyone knows it's all black and it's all full of all black, you know, lots of black middle-class families. And I lived in Northwest Atlanta, just slightly above Southwest, but it was like all a continuation of the same kind of neighborhood. But my neighborhood was even more unique in that it was built by, the homes that were in my neighborhood were built by black builders. It was a black developer that developed the entire neighborhood, black contractors, architects, and then all the homes were then bought by black doctors, dentists, lawyers, business people, civil rights leaders. And so the kind of pride that came from growing up in that kind of community. I mean, we even had tour buses that came through our neighborhood, because if you can believe this, people in the 60s and the 70s couldn't believe that there was a neighborhood like this for black, so many black accomplished people. That was the kind of neighborhood I grew up in, around these very accomplished people that did so much. I mean, nobody was super wealthy, but people were very focused on succeeding in life and had tremendous credentials. And that was inspiring for me.
What was your parents' marriage like?
Well, you know, I think it was tough. like most marriages, you know. They were married for my entire life. They had more of the traditional lifestyles. Like, my dad was the provider. My mom was really more the mom, right? Making sure the kids were okay and doing all those things. As I got older, though, it got to be more of a modern marriage, I would say, where my father knew what a brilliant woman my mom was. And when my mother served on city council for 13 years and decided to run for mayor, You know, he was long past the time where, you know, he didn't want his wife leaving the house. She had long gotten out of the house by then and was doing all these amazing things in the world. And he was her biggest champion for her as a candidate for mayor. And my dad was also, you know, had four girls and was very much a champion for girls and for us being super successful in our lives. And so, you know, it was, we had all the challenges that I think families have, but they stayed married. And I can appreciate, you know, staying married for 40 years and through all the ups and downs of that, right?
So, Stacey, tell us about the evolution from finance to the nonprofit world.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I learned early in my life from my family, I think, and my parents was that, especially because my dad was a physician, but he was also in the 60s, the president of the Atlanta branch of the NAACP. He was very involved, as most professional Black people were also really involved in the civil rights movement. They were the ones providing the medical care, the dental care, getting people out of jail, financing the civil rights movement, that kind of thing. You know a lot about the Martin Luther Kings and Ralph David Abernathy, who were, you know, they were my neighbors, but you don't often hear about those unsung heroes of the civil rights movement who were behind the scenes. And my dad was one of those. And I think from the life that my mom and dad led, it was very much that it wasn't enough for you just to have a professional career, that you had to give back, and sometimes at the same time. So even though I had this really strong interest in finance and business, and I, you know, had these internships in banking when I was in high school and into college, I was an intern at Chase Manhattan Bank, which was a really great opportunity for me. And then that went on, I was an econ major at Georgetown and then went to business school in Michigan and concentrating in finance. Through all that period of time, I really understood that even though I would have this really amazing career, probably in banking and finance, that I would have to give back. And that my, and what I really felt was that it was both important to be a business person that was, you know, that could do good at the same time. And so there was this, so even when I graduated from business school, I pursued a career in Wall Street, but in an area called public finance, not in corporate finance. So I worked in the area of Wall Street that was all about raising money for cities and counties and government to fund roads and bridges and hospitals and schools and all of those things. And that was what I wanted to do. I had really no desire by the time I graduated from business school to work in corporate finance. And then from there, I went to Fannie Mae, and that's the definition of Fannie Mae was a private company with a very public mission of providing home ownership and housing opportunities for families, but it was a publicly traded company. And then once I was at Fannie Mae and I spent half the time in the company, and then I became president and CEO of the Fannie Mae Foundation, which at the time was a separate entity from the company, totally funded by the company, but it was actually a standalone entity. That's what sort of branched me out into, launched me into a career in philanthropy and nonprofit. And then for me, the lines have been very blurred between for-profit and nonprofit and what's corporate and nonprofit. I mean, the fact of the matter is you can be a business person and still do good at the same time. You don't have to have these definitive lines that say, I'm a business person and a horrible person who doesn't care about community. Or I'm on this nonprofit side and I don't need to care about a P&L because I just run a nonprofit and nonprofits don't have, you know, P&Ls. Well, that's not true either. So,
Stacey, I don't think we can move away from Fannie Mae without asking you about the foreclosure crisis.
Well, that's a long story. Probably we need phase two of that show. You know, so yeah, I was at Fannie Mae. Really, there's a story to this, which was Fannie Mae hit a real bump in the road in 2005, 3 years before the housing crisis, when it faced a really big financial restatement. It was a $1 billion restatement, and I won't go into a lot of details around that, but it really shook the company at its core. There was a leadership change at the company. I still remain at the foundation. But then when the housing crisis hit in 2000, you know, going 2007, 2008, 2009, it was really clear at that point that, you know, the economy was heading into a tailspin. And being at Fannie Mae at the time was difficult because the housing crisis got sort of blamed on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, the narrative from that was, well, it was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that sort of brought down the whole housing market. And that simply was not true. What brought down the housing market, in my mind, were the poor lending standards by mainly unregulated financial institutions that then helped to spiral the entire industry out of control. Subprime lending that really gotten out of control, that was not regulated. And investors who really didn't know what they were investing in, and a lot of lax lending restrictions, guidelines. And that was really the beginning of it. Now, of course, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got sucked into it, and that was a tough time. And I was still head of the foundation. We brought the foundation back into the company. The foundation had been doing a lot of consumer-related work, right? We were doing a lot of consumer education to help people for years up until the housing crisis, to help people understand about how to establish good credit, how to move from being a renter to being a first-time homeowner. We ran ads on television to help get information out to people. We had materials in multiple languages to speak to different people of new immigrant communities and things like that. Well, by the time I came back into the company, right at the midst of the crisis, I was really one of the few people in the company of Fannie Mae that really had any sense or connection to consumers, to actual homeowners, because Fannie Mae as a company was really in the secondary mortgage market. The customers of Fannie Mae were not actual home buyers. They were then and are still banks and mortgage lending institutions, and it was more of a B2B model. But I had more of a B2C experience at the foundation. So I spent a lot of time with our CEO in our loss mitigation efforts, trying to help the company work with servicers to navigate borrower attitudes and borrower behavior during a financial crisis. And that was really interesting, because I think a lot of people weren't clear about how borrowers would they continue to make their mortgage payments? Could they? Would they walk away from their mortgages, which many of them did, or would they stay? And we do know, the last thing I'll just say about this is, we do know that some of the worst and the most egregious lending practices were directed towards communities of color. And there were lots of black and brown people who ended up losing their homes. And it was a huge and very, very tragic wealth transfer out of communities of color, just when we were beginning to build up wealth with expanded home ownership, especially through the 90s and the early 2000s. So it was a tragic moment. And you know, some communities are still trying to recover from that, you know, and now we're in the midst of another tragedy with the pandemic. So it's tough.
And now for a quick break.
So what has it been like to lead through the pandemic?
It's been a real experience. And I think, I think for anyone, if you're the president and CEO of any organization, whether it's a company or a nonprofit, it has not been for the faint of heart, right? It is something that you have to wake up every day, assess the situation. One of the things that I have always thought about leadership is that you never have perfect information, but sometimes you also don't have the luxury of time to act and make decisions, and you have to do it with the best information you have at the moment, right? So the pandemic has been a constantly evolving situation. You know, even back in March of 2000, when we were wondering whether or not we would go into full lockdown mode, or even I would say February, when we started to get a sense that, wait, there's something really bad happening. But we remember we really didn't know. We didn't have the full story. We know now we weren't being told the full story of whatever the story was that anyone knew at that time. And so a lot of us were just left to make some decisions. So, for example, we have at the March of Dimes, from March until May is one of our biggest fundraising seasons. It's when we have all of our March for Babies walks. They're all outdoors, which was a nice thing. But in the springtime, you know, we got hundreds and thousands of people gathering in parks or public places to raise money for the March of Dimes and for moms and babies. And we, without enough information on how the pandemic was affecting communities, even by that time, what we needed to do to stay safe, we just had to make a call to say, we don't think it's responsible at this point to bring people together. So we had to virtualize overnight all of those in-person events when nobody had a clue how to do that. And my team got amazingly creative, and we just pulled together and decided on a plan. We didn't do as well financially, and that was a whole nother issue, is how do you keep things afloat when revenue is down 10, 20, 30, 40%. Fortunately, by the end of the year, we were only, when a lot of organizations were down 50% of revenue, we were only down about 20%. We were able to find some really innovative ways to navigate. And then, of course, it wasn't just the pandemic. Remember, we also had the George Floyd, all of those issues to deal with, and Breonna Taylor, and many issues to deal with. So we, you know, 2020 was just like, I mean, we're going to look back on 2020 and just think, how in the world did we ever survive? And we're still not out of the woods now in 2021, and we're midway through the year. But I think it was, you know, it's interesting. I see a lot of people resigning from their jobs now. Of course, we saw a lot of women leave the workplace, unfortunately, just because they couldn't, understandably, you can't deal with it in the school and the virtual learning. But I've seen now a lot of CEOs that have there are a lot of nonprofits that are looking for new leadership, because I think a lot of people just got really exhausted from the whole experience. And it's unfortunate, because I think it was overwhelming for a lot of people, and I understand that.
How have you tried to care for your team virtually and through all of this? Because it's a lot.
Yeah, it's been a lot. Well, you know, I think one of the things that we try to do was to try to be first real understanding, especially we've got a lot of women who work at the March Dimes, a lot of young mothers who are trying to navigate work and virtual learning. So we tried our best to be as understanding about that, give people as much flexible time. The good thing is we had negotiated a contract with Zoom years ago. And so when people were sort of in 2020 trying to figure out, wait, what is Zoom again? I don't understand this thing. We were already well on our way. We've got a pretty virtualized workforce anyway. We've got a lot of folks who work from home, and not everyone works in an office at the March Dimes. So we were able to transition pretty well into a virtual daily work life, right? Because we were already there. But it still was trying to be very understanding to people's flexibility with respect to families. We have very generous paid family leave policies. So if someone needed to take care of a family member, we have generous policies that allow people to do that. New mothers that were expecting during the pandemic, allowing them time off to do that, paid time off to do that. And then I think just, you know, we couldn't really let our foot off the gas of trying to stay on track with our goals, because so many during the pandemic, you can't put pregnancy on pause, right? If you're pregnant, you had to continue with your pregnancy, and there were women looking for information. Well, how's COVID going to affect me? How might it affect my baby? Is the vaccine going to be safe? There are no clinical trials that include pregnant women. How do I know that the vaccine is going to work for me and it's not going to, you know, be damaging? So we had a ton of work that we still had to do to meet the needs of those folks. But in some ways, it was kind of rewarding to know that we were still so needed, and so many families were relying on us, women were relying on us. And I think the last thing I'll just say is that when George Floyd's death happened, his murder happened, it really gave corporate America a big wake-up call to health equity issues in general in the country. We were able to really highlight a lot of work we were doing on health equity. So that brought another area of opportunity for us to build new partnerships and attract new investment, because we were already on our way towards focusing on some of those issues. Because in maternal health, you know, Black women are still dying at 3 to 4 times out of white women. So we've got Black babies that die at twice the rate of white babies. We've got huge health equity issues. So the fact that we could talk about that work in the midst of this reckoning and awakening that America faced at the middle part of last year gave us a big opening to create new partnerships and new opportunities that brought new investment to us as well.
It seems like a big challenge of yours as a leader has been, understandably, March of Dimes is so big, and just figuring out where to put their money and what to fund and when to take funds away. Can you talk about that as a leader and sort of some of the criticism you have faced and how you have gotten through that?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of folks familiar with the March of Dimes, had never really heard the March of Dimes talk about health equity as much as we have in the past several years. And I think a lot of people have been on a journey with us to understand why we have some of the health equity issues we have. Some people that resist the idea that there should even be these health equity issues, or that it's the blame and the responsibility of Black and brown people that they're not as healthy as other people. Well, it must be your fault, right? I mean, that, I think there may have been a little bit of that early on when we started to say we have to focus on these issues. If we're going to make progress on maternal and infant health in this country, we can't do it without and ignore that too many Black and brown women and babies are left behind. And we just sort of unapologetically kept on that same message and embedded it into our strategy and embedded it as an important focus of every part of our work. And I know that we got some pushback from long-term donors and supporters who maybe had a hard time understanding those concepts and maybe even accepting them. But I think what we decided to do was to embed it in the values of the organization to such an extent that we would make it a part of everything that we do at the organization. And that's been important, because you're not going to make progress on these issues if you're just giving lip service to them anyway. And if they're not, they're so big and so hard to work on that if they're not a part of the very fundamental core of the organization, you're not going to make progress. So it's just been important to stay like very a degree of fortitude about it, I think, and remind ourselves of what we are about at the end of the day as an organization. If we say we're an organization that's about fighting for the health of all moms and babies, it has to mean all moms and babies. It can't mean some of them that live in these areas and others, I don't know, we'll get to that when we get to that. No, that's not what that means, right? So what does that mean?
And now for a quick break.
So you've had a number of executive roles. It's probably different for each one, but if you could give an example of how you were recruited or found the opportunity, because these aren't jobs that are like posted on Indeed generally, right?
Yeah. So let me just start by telling you this, that when I was at University of Michigan at the Ross Business School, and I made a decision, I heard an alum come back to the school talk about public finance, and I knew then, listening to him, that that was exactly what I wanted to do in my career. Even though all the other alums were talking about on this panel corporate finance, I said, no, I want to do public finance. The problem is that there weren't investment banks coming all the way halfway across the country to recruit for public finance jobs. And why should they? They could go to Wharton and Harvard and all the East Coast schools and recruit for those folks. So why should you come all the way to Michigan? So long story short, I ended up flying myself to New York. I cold called. I got a bunch of names of people that were in public finance. They didn't know me. I didn't know them. I just cold called them and I said, hey, I'd love to learn more about what you do. I'm interested in public finance. That's what I want to do. Can I just come and visit with you? I want to hear more about what you do. And I did that. I flew myself to New York. I got mugged in Brooklyn, staying with a friend, getting off the train while I was there. But I had all these meetings set up with investment bankers to talk about it. And, you know, I kind of knew that I wanted a job from one of them if they liked me, but I didn't. I led with, I want to learn. And I did. I really wanted to learn more about it. So I want to start with that to say that the beginning of my career was very, very much non-traditional. It was very much fly yourself, get yourself in front of people. What do you have to lose? Just go for it. And then once I got into jobs, and this is one thing I say to young people all the time, is if you want the next job, the bigger job, and I know this is something that your mom tells you or somebody else tells you, an adult in your life, you have to do a good job in the job you're in. Even if you're not happy in the job you're in, you better do a good job in the job you're in, because why would anybody give you another opportunity if you're not already, you know, hitting the ball out of the park? And I would also say that the only way to do the best job possible is to make the best decisions, the best choice possible about where to go. So some people will make choices about, oh, I'll just go do this job for a while because I really want to get to something else. Well, you know what? I can guarantee you if you're sort of half-heartedly going into the job, you're probably going to do a half-ass job, right, in the position. And it's not going to, and then the next opportunity is not going to pan out. So there were plenty of things that positions that I may have thought I wanted to do or pursue that didn't work out. And then the next opportunity came and it did work out. And it ended up that was actually the perfect job for me, right? Or it was definitely a job that I felt like I would love to do this job. And I'm going to go into it feeling super excited about doing it. And every time I did take on the next opportunity, I did feel that way. And I did do a good job. And that then led to the next thing. So for me, it's, you're right. The jobs are not usually on Indeed, because when somebody notices you doing a good job, they come to you and say, would you be interested? That's what happened when I was at Fannie Mae and I got approached about would I be interested in being the president and CEO of the foundation. And the first thing I said was no, because I thought it paid less. Right. And remember, I'm always trying to do better for myself. Right. Turns out it was financially great. And from a career perspective, it was great. And then when I decided that I was ready to leave Fannie Mae, I had made a lot of connections with headhunters who were calling me for different opportunities. And that's really how executive jobs happen, is you start to cultivate a relationship with headhunters. I would always encourage people to be super nice to people in executive search, because even if that one opportunity doesn't pan out or you're not interested, if you help them out and connect them with somebody who might be good for the job, or if you just develop a relationship with them, they'll keep you in mind for the next thing. And I have a ton of friends that are in executive search just because I've gotten to know them over time. They've called me and I've talked to them about different things, and it's been helpful in terms of opening up doors for me as well as I've moved through my career.
So you and your husband both have really big careers. How have you managed side by side in terms of your division of labor at home and with your girls?
Yeah, well, I'm really blessed to have a husband who is super ambitious and also super dedicated to being the best dad he can be. And, you know, my father was a similar way, but the vision and the perspective of what it looked like to be a father when my dad was a dad is very different from what it looks like today in 2021. And I'm really happy about how things have evolved, how men, a lot of them, do want to have a more active role in fatherhood, do want to play, you know, a bigger role in their kids' lives and see them and where, you know, my husband and I have seen it as really a partnership. I think it's been incredible. And there are a lot of couples that, you know, are like that. Having said all that, there is so much that still falls on the shoulders and in the laps of moms. I don't know, moms have this thing where we anticipate things. Like we see the future and know where it's going. Like we have a sixth sense about what our kids will need before they need it, or what our kids are going to be, you know, we're planning ahead for what school is going to be looking like in the next couple years when we have to start thinking about transitioning our kids from one school to the next, or we're already thinking about childcare needs before our husbands are. And so as long as the husbands are there to take the tasks that we assign them, then that's really good because there was a time when dads wouldn't even do that. But, you know, the unfortunate reality of many working moms is we're still managing the overall household. And we're making those decisions for what's best for the home, what's best for our kids. And we're fortunate if we have a spouse or a partner who can be there to take on the tasks, like be the chief operating officer to our CEO role. And I don't mean to diminish it in one bit. And there certainly are things that my husband leads on that I don't, and I'm happy to have him lead on things. But I don't think I could be nearly as successful in my career if I didn't have the kind of husband who saw that his role was to be super responsible for all aspects of what it would take to help support our kids and their development, and not only financially, but in other ways as well. And I've been very blessed in that way.
Speaking of your daughters, what do they know about your work? Like, how involved have they been? What do they think about you as this executive?
I don't know. They, you know, I think that, well, first of all, I do know that they're super proud of me. When I have exciting things going on, like if I'm going to be on a television show, or I'll tell them about this podcast, for example, and they'll say, okay, mom, whatever, you know, and they'll give me that. Like, oh yeah, it's another one of you and you're talking about your March and I'm saying, I got it. But I think behind the scenes, they are super excited. And I'd like to think that they're super inspired. My daughter, both my girls are Girl Scouts. And my daughter, one daughter, the younger one, is working on a Gold Award, which for a lot of people, they may not know, the Gold Award is kind of like an Eagle Scout award. And my older daughter did her Gold Award on maternal health and addressing the maternal health crisis in Washington, D.C., and was just successful in getting the mayor to designate 2020 as Maternal Health Education and Awareness Day in the District of Columbia. And so clearly, I think I must have influenced her in that way to focus on that. Although she made her own choice about what to work on, I think I want to be that mom that is both showing that you can be successful, but also being a loving, caring mom at home too. And that's what I hope they take away from me. Although I'll be the last one to know from them how they actually think about me, because they'll never tell me, I'm sure. I'll have to hear from somebody else.
So you had a mom who was very involved in politics and ran for mayor of Atlanta. What is your political future going to be like?
Probably nothing, because I think once you go through a campaign like that of running for mayor, you quickly realize that it may not be something you want to do. I think there are many ways for me to have an impact on people's lives without necessarily being an elected official. I respect people that do run for office a great deal, because it's a huge sacrifice. But I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing. Because I do think I have a huge impact on people's lives. And that at the end of the day is what's most important to me, is that I use my skills, even my business training, to do good for others. And that's what's really most important to me.
All right, we are going to launch into our speed round, where we're just going to ask you a few quick questions and you can give us just spontaneous answers. Amy, you want to kick us off?
Stacey, what book are you reading?
Actually, I'm reading The Bluest Eye, and I've been kind of muddling my way through it, by Toni Morrison.
Who are your closest friends and how did you meet them?
Oh, wow. This is going to make me cry, because one of my very best friends just died about a week and a half ago.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And her daughter is my goddaughter. And most of my very good friends, I only have a handful of them. And they're mainly women that I grew up with in Atlanta. One of them is my sorority sister, but my friends are the friends I've had for all my life, most of my life.
What is your nighttime routine?
I usually watch sports, some sort of whatever sports are on. We just had the Olympics and I was watching a WNBA game. I'm a huge sports fan. My alter ego is Sports Mom DMV. I'm a big advocate for girls' sports in the Washington, D.C. area. So I'm usually looking at sports, and then I look at TikTok and I go to bed.
Who leaves you starstruck?
I would say Michelle Obama.
All right, Lou.
You're up.
My question is basically, I always want to know what CEOs spend their money on. And then in the process, before you spend the money, is there something that you're saving for?
Oh, my God. So for me, what I spend my money on is private school and college tuition. So that's like the, that's like the big thing. I'm saving for my European river cruise. And I hope I don't have to wait till my 60th birthday. That's not that far away, but maybe that's what it is I'm saving for that. And then saving for a bunch of travel when my kids are finally out of college.
So two things stood out to me, Amy, from this interview. I mean, Stacey is extraordinary, but one of the fascinating things is A, her mom, who is this dynamo, who was valedictorian of her high school, and it was just understood that she was basically not allowed to use all of her talent and work and reach her potential, which it sounds like she maybe did later on, but it was all of those lost years. And then the other thing that struck me was just this incredible place she grew up, because I do think we don't think enough or talk enough about how your environment shapes you in terms of ambition and how being around certain kinds of people just makes you want to be your best self.
I think those are two very good points. To the first one, when Stacey was talking about her mom, I just kept going back to Nancy Pelosi in my mind, because not a lot of people know this about Nancy Pelosi, but she did not work. She raised kids for decades. And then after her five kids were older, she went back to work.
Wow.
And she developed this career that's been pretty successful, I would say, right? As Speaker of the House. Well, one of the most powerful women in America. But anyway, it's just, and to your point, I think it's so true. I think that was really the expectation of brilliant, ambitious women, you know, decades ago, that they wouldn't work, right? That wasn't a path for them. My mother worked my entire life, but she talks about her career choices as limited to being a teacher or a nurse.
Oh, absolutely. I remember when my mom, I remember there was a preschool teacher who said to Ella, oh, you'd be a great teacher. And my mom trained me to think like we could never be a teacher because that was the only opportunity for women in a certain generation. So you never wanted to be the one thing you were limited to.
My mother told me I couldn't be a teacher because I would be a horrible teacher. Not that I My mother was an amazing teacher, but she is right. I would have been a horrible teacher. It's too hard. But it goes to this point of what you're talking about, where Stacey grew up, which sounds like a very remarkable place. Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Para, our social media manager, Phoebe Cranefuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.